22. Milo the Mayor. That was the mission on which Yossarian lost his nerve. Yossarian lost his nerve on the mission to Avignon because Snowden lost his guts. And Snowden lost his guts because their pilot that day was Hoople, who was only 15 years old. And their co-pilot was Dobbs, who was even worse, and who wanted Yossarian to join with him in a plot to murder Colonel Cathcart. Hoople was a good pilot, Yossarian knew, but he was only a kid. And Dobbs had no confidence in him either, and wrested the controls away without warning after they had dropped their bombs, going berserk in midair and tipping the plane over into that heart-stopping, ear-splitting, indescribably petrifying fatal dive that tore Yossarian's earphones free from their connection and hung him helplessly to the roof of the nose by the top of his head. "Oh, God!" Yossarian had shrieked soundlessly as he felt them all falling. "Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God!" he had shrieked beseechingly through lips that could not open as the plane fell, and he dangled without weight by the top of his head until Hoople managed to seize the controls back and leveled the plane out down inside the crazy, craggy patchwork canyon of crashing anti-aircraft fire from which they had climbed away and from which they would now have to escape again. Almost at once there was a thud and a hole the size of a big fist in the plexiglass. Yossarian's cheeks were stinging with shimmering splinters. There was no blood.
"What happened? What happened?"
he cried and trembled violently when he could not hear his own voice in his ears. He was cowed by the empty silence on the intercom and almost too horrified to move as he crouched like a trapped mouse on his hands and knees and waited without daring to breathe until he finally spied the gleaming cylindrical jack plug of his headset swinging back and forth in front of his eyes and jammed it back into its receptacle with fingers that rattled.
"Oh, God!"
he kept shrieking with no abatement of terror as the flak thumped and mushroomed all about him.
"Oh, God!"
Dobbs was weeping when Yossarian jammed his jack plug back into the intercom system and was able to hear again.
"Help him! Help him!"
Dobbs was sobbing.
"Help him! Help him!"
"Help who? Help who?"
Yossarian called back.
"Help who?" "The bombardier! The bombardier!"
Dobbs cried.
"He doesn't answer! Help the bombardier! Help the bombardier!"
"I'm the bombardier!"
Yossarian cried back at him.
"I'm the bombardier! I'm all right! I'm all right!" "Then help him! Help him!"
Dobbs wept.
"Help him! Help him! Help who? Help who?" "The radio gunner,"
Dobbs begged.
"Help the radio gunner!"
"I'm cold,"
Snowden whimpered feebly over the intercom system, then in a bleat of plaintive agony.
"Please help me. I'm cold."
And Yossarian crept out through the crawlway and climbed up over the bomb bay and down into the rear section of the plane where Snowden lay on the floor, wounded and freezing to death in a yellow splash of sunlight near the new tail gunner, lying stretched out on the floor beside him in a dead faint. Dobbs was the worst pilot in the world and knew it. A shattered wreck of a virile young man who was continually striving to convince his superiors that he was no longer fit to pilot a plane. None of his superiors would listen, and it was the day the number of missions was raised to 60 that Dobbs stole into Yossarian's tent while Orr was out looking for gaskets and disclosed the plot he had formulated to murder Colonel Cathcart. He needed Yossarian's assistance.
"You want us to kill him in cold blood?" Yossarian objected.
"That's right,"
Dobbs agreed with an optimistic smile, encouraged by Yossarian's ready grasp of the situation.
"We'll shoot him to death with the Luger I brought back from Sicily that nobody knows I've got."
"I don't think I could do it,"
Yossarian concluded, after weighing the idea in silence a while. Dobbs was astonished.
"Why not?"
"Look, Nothing would please me more than to have the son of a bitch break his neck or get killed in a crash or to find out that someone else had shot him to death. But I don't think I could kill him.
He'd do it to you,
Dobbs argued.
In fact, you're the one who told me he is doing it to us by keeping us in combat so long.
But I don't think I could do it to him. He's got a right to live, too, I guess.
Not as long as he's trying to rob you and me of our right to live. What's the matter with you?
Dobbs was flabbergasted.
I used to listen to you arguing that same thing with Clevenger. And look what happened to him, right inside that cloud.
Stop shouting, will you? Yossarian shushed him.
I'm not shouting,
Dobbs shouted louder, his face red with revolutionary fervor. His eyes and nostrils were running, and his palpitating crimson lower lip was splattered with a foamy dew.
There must have been close to 100 men in the group who had finished their 55 missions when he raised the number to 60.
There must have been at least another 100 like you with just a couple more to fly.
He's going to kill us all if we let him go on forever. We got to kill him first.
Yossarian nodded expressionlessly, without committing himself.
You think we could get away with it?
I got it all worked out.
Stop shouting, for Christ's sake.
I'm not shouting. I've got to...
Will you stop shouting?
I got it all worked out,
Dobbs whispered, gripping the side of Orr's cot with white-knuckled hands to constrain them from waving.
Thursday morning, when he's due back from that goddamn farmhouse of his in the hills, I'll sneak up through the woods to that hairpin turn in the road and hide in the bushes. He has to slow down there, and I can watch the road in both directions to make sure there's no one else around. When I see him coming, I'll shove a big log out into the road to make him stop his jeep. Then I'll step out of the bushes with my Luger and shoot him in the head till he's dead. I'll bury the gun, come back down through the woods to the squadron, and go about my business just like everybody else. What could possibly go wrong?
Yossarian had followed each step attentively.
Where do I come in? He asked in puzzlement.
I couldn't do it without you,
Dobbs explained.
I need you to tell me to go ahead.
Yossarian found it hard to believe him.
Is that all you want me to do? Just tell you to go ahead?
That's all I need from you,
Dobbs answered.
Just tell me to go ahead, and I'll blow his brains out all by myself the day after tomorrow.
His voice was accelerating with emotion and rising again.
I'd like to shoot Colonel Korn in the head, too, while we're at it. Although I'd like to spare Major Danby if it's all right with you. And then I'd like to murder Appleby and Havermeyer also. And after we finish murdering Appleby and Havermeyer, I'd like to murder McWatt.
McWatt?
Cried Yossarian, almost jumping up in horror.
McWatt's a friend of mine. What do you want from McWatt?
I don't know,
Dobbs confessed with an air of floundering embarrassment.
I just thought that as long as we were murdering Appleby and Havermeyer, we might as well murder McWatt, too. Don't you want to murder McWatt?
Yossarian took a firm stand.
Look, I might keep interested in this if you stop shouting it all over the island and if you stick to killing Colonel Cathcart. But if you're going to turn this into a bloodbath, you can forget about me.
All right. All right.
Dobbs sought to placate him.
Just Colonel Cathcart. Should I do it? Tell me to go ahead.
Yossarian shook his head.
I don't think I could tell you to go ahead.
Dobbs was frantic.
I'm willing to compromise, he pleaded vehemently. You don't have to tell me to go ahead. Just tell me it's a good idea, okay? Is it a good idea?
Yossarian still shook his head.
It would have been a great idea if you'd gone ahead and done it without even speaking to me. Now, it's too late. I don't think I can tell you anything. Give me some more time. I might change my mind.
Then it will be too late.
Yossarian kept shaking his head. Dobbs was disappointed. He sat for a moment with a hangdog look, then spurted to his feet suddenly and stamped away to have another impetuous crack at persuading Dr. Nika to ground him.
knocking over Yossarian's washstand with his hip when he lurched around and tripping over the fuel line of the stove Orr was still constructing. Dr. Nika withstood Dobb's blustering and gesticulating attack with a series of impatient nods and sent him to the medical tent to describe his symptoms to Gus and Wes, who painted his gums purple with gentian violet solution the moment he started to talk. They painted his toes purple, too, and forced a laxative down his throat when he opened his mouth again to complain, and then they sent him away. Dobbs was in even worse shape than Hungry Joe, who could at least fly missions when he was not having nightmares. Dobbs was almost as bad as Orr, who seemed happy as an undersized grinning lark, with his deranged and galvanic giggle and shivering warped buck teeth, and who was sent along for a rest leave with Milo and Yossarian on the trip to Cairo for eggs, when Milo bought cotton instead and took off at dawn for Istanbul with his plane packed to the gun turrets with exotic spiders and unripened red bananas. Orr was one of the homeliest freaks Yossarian had ever encountered, and one of the most attractive. He had a raw, bulgy face with hazel eyes squeezing from their sockets like matching brown halves of marbles, and thick, wavy, parti-colored hair sloping up to a peak on the top of his head like a pomaded pup tent. Orr was knocked down into the water or had an engine shot out almost every time he went up, and he began jerking on Yossarian's arm like a wild man after they had taken off for Naples and come down in Sicily, to find the scheming, cigar-smoking 10-year-old pimp with the 2 12-year-old virgin sisters waiting for them in town in front of the hotel in which there was room for only Milo. Yossarian pulled back from Orr adamantly, gazing with some concern and bewilderment at Mount Etna instead of Mount Vesuvius, and wondering what they were doing in Sicily instead of Naples, as Orr kept entreating him in a tittering, stuttering, concupiscent turmoil to go along with him behind the scheming 10-year-old pimp to his 2 12-year-old virgin sisters, who were not really virgins and not really sisters, and who were really only 28.
"Go with him,"
Milo instructed Yossarian laconically.
"Remember your mission."
"All right," Yossarian yielded with a sigh, remembering his mission. "But at least let me try to find a hotel room first so I can get a good night's sleep afterward."
"You'll get a good night's sleep with the girls,"
Milo replied with the same air of intrigue.
"Remember your mission."
But they got no sleep at all, for Yossarian and Orr found themselves jammed into the same double bed with the 2 12-year-old, 28-year-old prostitutes, who turned out to be oily and obese, and who kept waking them up all night long to ask them to switch partners. Yossarian's perceptions were soon so fuzzy that he paid no notice to the beige turban the fat one crowding into him kept wearing, until late the next morning, when the scheming 10-year-old pimp with the Cuban panatella snatched it off in public in a bestial caprice that exposed in the brilliant Sicilian daylight her shocking, misshapen, and denuded skull. Vengeful neighbors had shaved her hair to the gleaming bone because she had slept with Germans. The girls screeched in feminine outrage and waddled comically after the scheming 10-year-old pimp, her grisly, bleak, violated scalp slithering up and down ludicrously around the queer, darkened wart of her face like something bleached and obscene. Yossarian had never laid eyes on anything so bare before. The pimp spun the turban high on his finger like a trophy and kept himself skipping inches ahead of her fingertips, as he led her in a tantalizing circle around the square, congested with people who were howling with laughter and pointing to Yossarian with derision, when Milo strode up with a grim look of haste and puckered his lips reprovingly at the unseemly spectacle of so much vice and frivolity. Milo insisted on leaving at once for Malta.
"We're sleepy,"
Orr whined.
"That's your own fault," Milo censured them both self-righteously. "If you had spent the night in your hotel room instead of with these immoral girls, you'd both feel as good as I do today."
"You told us to go with them," Yossarian retorted accusingly. "And we didn't have a hotel room. You were the only one who could get a hotel room."
"That wasn't my fault either," Milo explained haughtily.
How was I supposed to know all the buyers would be in town for the chickpea harvest?
You knew it, Yossarian charged. That explains why we're here in Sicily instead of Naples. You probably got the whole damned plane filled with chickpeas already.
Shh, Milo cautioned sternly with a meaningful glance toward Orr. Remember your mission. The bomb bay, the rear and tail sections of the plane, and most of the top turret gunner section were all filled with bushels of chickpeas when they arrived at the airfield to take off for Malta. Yossarian's mission on the trip was to distract Orr from observing where Milo bought his eggs, even though Orr was a member of Milo's syndicate and, like every other member of Milo's syndicate, owned a share. His mission was silly, Yossarian felt, since it was common knowledge that Milo bought his eggs in Malta for 7 cents apiece and sold them to the mess halls in his syndicate for 5 cents apiece. I just don't trust him, Milo brooded in the plane with a backward nod toward Orr, who was curled up like a tangled rope on the low bushels of chickpeas, trying torturedly to sleep. And I just as soon buy my eggs when he's not around to learn my business secrets. What else don't you understand? Yossarian was riding beside him in the co-pilot seat.
I don't understand why you buy eggs for 7 cents apiece in Malta and sell them for 5 cents.
I do it to make a profit.
But how can you make a profit? You lose 2 cents an egg.
But I make a profit of 3¼ cents an egg by selling them for 4¼ cents an egg to the people in Malta I buy them from for 7 cents an egg. Of course, I don't make the profit. The syndicate makes the profit, and everybody has a share.
Yossarian felt he was beginning to understand. And the people you sell the eggs to at 4¼ cents apiece make a profit of 2¾ cents apiece when they sell them back to you at 7 cents apiece. Is that right? Why don't you sell the eggs directly to you and eliminate the people you buy them from?
Because I'm the people I buy them from, Milo explained. I make a profit of 3¼ cents apiece when I sell them to me, and a profit of 2¾ cents apiece when I buy them back from me. That's a total profit of 6 cents an egg. I lose only 2 cents an egg when I sell them to the mess halls at 5 cents apiece, and that's how I can make a profit buying eggs for 7 cents apiece and selling them for 5 cents apiece. I pay only 1 cent apiece at the hen when I buy them in Sicily.
In Malta, Yossarian corrected. You buy your eggs in Malta, not Sicily.
Milo chortled proudly. I don't buy eggs in Malta, he confessed with an air of slight and clandestine amusement that was the only departure from industrious sobriety Yossarian had ever seen him make. I buy them in Sicily for 1 cent apiece and transfer them to Malta secretly at 4½ cents apiece in order to get the price of eggs up to 7 cents apiece when people come to Malta looking for them.
Why do people come to Malta for eggs when they're so expensive there?
Because they've always done it that way.
Why don't they look for eggs in Sicily?
Because they've never done it that way.
Now I really don't understand. Why don't you sell your mess halls the eggs for 7 cents apiece instead of for 5 cents apiece?
Because my mess halls would have no need for me then. Anyone can buy 7 cent apiece eggs for 7 cents apiece.
Why don't they bypass you and buy the eggs directly from you in Malta at 4¼ cents apiece?
Because I wouldn't sell it to them.
Why wouldn't you sell it to them?
Because then there wouldn't be as much room for a profit. At least this way I can make a bit for myself as a middleman.
Then you do make a profit for yourself, Yossarian declared.
Of course I do. But it all goes to the syndicate, and everybody has a share. Don't you understand? It's exactly what happens to those plum tomatoes I sell to Colonel Cathcart.
Buy, Yossarian corrected him. You don't sell plum tomatoes to Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn. You buy plum tomatoes from them.
No, sell, Milo corrected Yossarian. I distribute my plum tomatoes in markets all over Pianosa under an assumed name, so that Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn can buy them up from me under their assumed names at 4 cents apiece and sell them back to me the next day for the syndicate at 5 cents apiece. They make a profit of 1 cent apiece, I make a profit of 3½ cents apiece, and everybody comes out ahead.
everybody but the syndicate,
said Yossarian with a snort. The syndicate is paying 5 cents apiece for plum tomatoes that cost you only half a cent apiece. How does the syndicate benefit?
The syndicate benefits when I benefit, Milo explained, because everybody has a share, and the syndicate gets Colonel Cathcart's and Colonel Korn's support so that they'll let me go out on trips like this one. You'll see how much profit that can mean in about 15 minutes when we land in Palermo.
Malta, Yossarian corrected him. We're flying to Malta now, not Palermo.
No, we're flying to Palermo,
Milo answered.
There's an endive exporter in Palermo I have to see for a minute about a shipment of mushrooms to burn that were damaged by mold.
Milo, how do you do it?
Yossarian inquired with laughing amazement and admiration.
You fill out a flight plan for one place, and then you go to another. Don't the people in the control towers ever raise hell?
They all belong to the syndicate,
Milo said.
And they know that what's good for the syndicate is good for the country, because that's what makes Sammy run. The men in the control towers have a share, too, and that's why they always have to do whatever they can to help the syndicate.
Do I have a share?
Everybody has a share.
Does Orr have a share?
Everybody has a share.
And Hungry Joe? He has a share, too?
Everybody has a share.
Well, I'll be damned,
mused Yossarian, deeply impressed with the idea of a share for the very first time. Milo turned toward him with a faint glimmer of mischief.
I have a surefire plan for cheating the federal government out of $6,000. We can make $3,000 apiece without any risk to either of us. Are you interested?
No.
Milo looked at Yossarian with profound emotion.
That's what I like about you, he exclaimed. You're honest. You're the only one I know that I can really trust. That's why I wish you'd try to be of more help to me. I really was disappointed when you ran off with those two tramps in Catania yesterday.
Yossarian stared at Milo in quizzical disbelief.
Milo, you told me to go with them. Don't you remember?
That wasn't my fault,
Milo answered with dignity.
I had to get rid of Orr some way once we reached town. It will be a lot different in Palermo. When we land in Palermo, I want you and Orr to leave with the girls right from the airport.
With what girls?
I radioed ahead and made arrangements with a 4-year-old pimp to supply you and Orr with 2 8-year-old virgins who are half Spanish. He'll be waiting at the airport in a limousine. Go right in as soon as you step out of the plane.
Nothing doing, said Yossarian, shaking his head. The only place I'm going is to sleep.
Milo turned livid with indignation, his slim, long nose flickering spasmodically between his black eyebrows and his unbalanced orange-brown mustache like the pale, thin flame of a single candle.
Yossarian, remember your mission,
he reminded reverently.
To hell with my mission, Yossarian responded indifferently. And to hell with the syndicate, too, even though I do have a share. I don't want any 8-year-old virgins, even if they are half Spanish.
I don't blame you, but these 8-year-old virgins are really only 32, and they're not really half Spanish, but only 1/3 Estonian.
I don't care for any virgins.
And they're not even virgins,
Milo continued persuasively.
The one I picked out for you was married for a short time to an elderly schoolteacher who slept with her only on Sundays, so she's really almost as good as new.
But Orr was sleepy, too, and Yossarian and Orr were both at Milo's side when they rode into the city of Palermo from the airport and discovered that there was no room for the two of them at the hotel there, either, and more important, that Milo was mayor. The weird, implausible reception for Milo began at the airfield, where civilian laborers who recognized him halted in their duties respectfully to gaze at him with full expressions of controlled exuberance and adulation. News of his arrival preceded him into the city, and the outskirts were already crowded with cheering citizens as they sped by in their small, uncovered truck. Yossarian and Orr were mystified and mute and pressed close against Milo for security. Inside the city, the welcome for Milo grew louder as the truck slowed and eased deeper toward the middle of town.
Small boys and girls had been released from school and were lining the sidewalks in new clothes, waving tiny flags. Yossarian and Orr were absolutely speechless now. The streets were jammed with joyous throngs, and strung overhead were huge banners bearing Milo's picture. Milo had posed for these pictures in a drab peasant's blouse with a high, round collar, and his scrupulous paternal countenance was tolerant, wise, critical, and strong as he stared out at the populace omnisciently, with his undisciplined mustache and disunited eyes. Sinking invalids blew kisses to him from windows. Aproned shopkeepers cheered ecstatically from the narrow doorways of their shops. Tubas crumped. Here and there a person fell and was trampled to death. Sobbing old women swarmed through each other frantically around the slow-moving truck to touch Milo's shoulder or press his hand. Milo bore the tumultuous celebration with benevolent grace. He waved back to everyone in elegant reciprocation and showered generous handfuls of foil-covered Hershey kisses to the rejoicing multitudes. Lines of lusty young boys and girls skipped along behind him with their arms linked, chanting in hoarse and glassy-eyed adoration, "Milo! Milo! Milo!" Now that his secret was out, Milo relaxed with Yossarian and Orr and inflated opulently with a vast, shy pride. His cheeks turned flesh-colored. Milo had been elected mayor of Palermo and of nearby Carini, Monreale, Bagheria, Termini Imerese, Cefalu, Mistretta, and Nicosia as well, because he had brought scotch to Sicily. Yossarian was amazed.
"The people here like to drink scotch that much?"
"They don't drink any of the scotch," Milo explained. "Scotch is very expensive, and these people here are very poor."
"Then why do you import it to Sicily if nobody drinks any?"
"To build up a price. I move the scotch here from Malta to make more room for profit when I sell it back to me for somebody else. I created a whole new industry here. Today, Sicily is the third largest exporter of scotch in the world. And that's why they elected me mayor."
"How about getting us a hotel room if you're such a hotshot?"
Orr grumbled impertinently in a voice slurred with fatigue. Milo responded contritely.
"That's just what I'm going to do," he promised. "I'm really sorry about forgetting to radio ahead for hotel rooms for you two. Come along to my office and I'll speak to my deputy mayor about it right now."
Milo's office was a barber shop, and his deputy mayor was a pudgy barber from whose obsequious lips cordial greetings foamed as effusively as the lather he began whipping up in Milo's shaving cup.
"Well, Vittorio," said Milo, settling back lazily in one of Vittorio's barber chairs, "how are things in my absence this time?"
"Very sad, Signor Milo, very sad. But now that you're back, the people are all happy again."
"I was wondering about the size of the crowds. How come the hotels are all full?"
"Because so many people from other cities are here to see you, Signor Milo. And because we have all the buyers who have come into town for the artichoke auction."
Milo's hand soared up perpendicularly like an eagle and arrested Vittorio's shaving brush.
"What's artichoke?" he inquired.
"Artichoke, Signor Milo. An artichoke is a very tasty vegetable that's popular everywhere. You must try some artichokes while you're here, Signor Milo. We grow the best in the world."
"Really?" said Milo. "How much are artichokes selling for this year?"
"It looked like a very good year for artichokes. The crops were very bad."
"Is that a fact?" mused Milo,
and was gone, sliding from his chair so swiftly that his striped barber's apron retained his shape for a second or two after he had gone before it collapsed. Milo had vanished from sight by the time Yossarian and Orr rushed after him to the doorway.
"Next!" barked Milo's deputy mayor officiously. "Who's next?"
Yossarian and Orr walked from the barber shop in dejection. Deserted by Milo, they trudged homelessly through the reveling masses in futile search of a place to sleep. Yossarian was exhausted. His head throbbed with a dull, debilitating pain, and he was irritable with Orr, who had found two crab apples somewhere and walked with them in his cheeks until Yossarian spied them there and made him take them out. Then Orr found two horse chestnuts somewhere and slipped those in until Yossarian detected them and snapped at him again to take the crab apples out of his mouth. Orr grinned and replied that they were not crab apples, but horse chestnuts, and that they were not in his mouth, but in his hands. But Yossarian was not able to understand a single word he said because of the horse chestnuts in his mouth, and made him take them out anyway. A sly light twinkled in Orr's eyes. He rubbed his forehead harshly with his knuckles like a man in an alcoholic stupor, and snickered lewdly.
"You remember that girl?"
He broke off to snicker lewdly again.
"Do you remember that girl who was hitting me over the head with that shoe in that apartment in Rome when we were both naked?"
he asked with a look of cunning expectation. He waited until Yossarian nodded cautiously.
"If you'll let me put the chestnuts back in my mouth, I'll tell you why she was hitting me. Is that a deal?"
Yossarian nodded, and Orr told him the whole fantastic story of why the naked girl in Natalie's whore's apartment was hitting him over the head with her shoe. But Yossarian was not able to understand a single word because the horse chestnuts were back in his mouth. Yossarian roared with exasperated laughter at the trick. But in the end, there was nothing for them to do when night fell but eat a damp dinner in a dirty restaurant and hitch a ride back to the airfield, where they slept on the chill metal floor of the plane and turned and tossed in groaning torment until the truck drivers blasted up less than 2 hours later with their crates of artichokes and chased them out onto the ground while they filled up the plane. A heavy rain began falling. Yossarian and Orr were dripping wet by the time the trucks drove away and had no choice but to squeeze themselves back into the plane and roll themselves up like shivering anchovies between the jolting corners of the crates of artichokes that Milo flew up to Naples at dawn and exchanged for the cinnamon sticks, cloves, vanilla beans, and pepper pods that he rushed right back down south with that same day to Malta, where it turned out he was assistant governor general. There was no room for Yossarian and Orr in Malta, either. Milo was Major Sir Milo Minderbinder in Malta and had a gigantic office in the Governor General's building. His mahogany desk was immense. In a panel of the oak wall between crossed British flags hung a dramatic, arresting photograph of Major Sir Milo Minderbinder in the dress uniform of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. His mustache in the photograph was clipped and narrow. His chin was chiseled, and his eyes were sharp as thorns. Milo had been knighted, commissioned a major in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, and named Assistant Governor General of Malta because he had brought the egg trade there. He gave Yossarian and Orr generous permission to spend the night on the thick carpet in his office, but shortly after he left, a sentry in battle dress appeared and drove them from the building at the tip of his bayonet. And they rode out exhaustedly to the airport with a surly cab driver who overcharged them and went to sleep inside the plane again, which was filled now with leaking gunny sacks of cocoa and freshly ground coffee and reeking with an odor so rich that they were both outside retching violently against the landing gear when Milo was chauffeured up the first thing the next morning looking fit as a fiddle and took right off for Iran, where there was again no room at the hotel for Yossarian and Orr, and where Milo was vice shah. Milo had at his disposal sumptuous quarters inside a salmon-pink palace, but Yossarian and Orr were not allowed to accompany him inside because they were Christian infidels. They were stopped at the gates by gargantuan Berber guards with scimitars and chased away. Orr was snuffling and sneezing with a crippling head cold. Yossarian's broad back was bent and aching. He was ready to break Milo's neck, but Milo was vice-shah of Iran, and his person was sacred. Milo was not only the vice-shah of Iran, as it turned out, but also the caliph of Baghdad, the imam of Damascus, and the sheikh of Araby. Milo was the corn god, the rain god, and the rice god, in backward regions where such crude gods were still worshipped by ignorant and superstitious people, and deep inside the jungles of Africa, he intimated with becoming modesty, large graven images of his mustached face could be found overlooking primitive stone altars red with human blood. Everywhere they touched, he was acclaimed with honor. and it was one triumphal ovation after another for him in city after city, until they finally doubled back through the Middle East and reached Cairo, where Milo cornered the market on cotton that no one else in the world wanted and brought himself promptly to the brink of ruin. In Cairo, there was at last room at the hotel for Yossarian and Orr. There were soft beds for them with fat, fluffed-up pillows and clean, crisp sheets. There were closets with hangers for their clothes. There was water to wash with. Yossarian and Orr soaked their rancid, unfriendly bodies pink in a steaming hot tub and then went from the hotel with Milo to eat shrimp cocktails and filet mignon in a very fine restaurant with a stock ticker in the lobby that happened to be clicking out the latest quotation for Egyptian cotton when Milo inquired of the captain of waiters what kind of machine it was. Milo had never imagined a machine so beautiful as a stock ticker before. "Really?" he exclaimed when the captain of waiters had finished his explanation. "And how much is Egyptian cotton selling for?" The captain of waiters told him, and Milo bought the whole crop. But Yossarian was not nearly so frightened by the Egyptian cotton Milo bought as he was by the bunches of green-red bananas Milo had spotted in the native marketplace as they drove into the city, and his fears proved justified, for Milo shook him awake out of a deep sleep just after 12 and shoved a partly peeled banana toward him. Yossarian choked back a sob.
"Taste it,"
Milo urged, following Yossarian's writhing face around with the banana insistently.
"Milo, you bastard," moaned Yossarian. "I've got to get some sleep."
"Eat it and tell me if it's good,"
Milo persevered.
"Don't tell Orr I gave it to you. I charged him 2 piastres for his."
Yossarian ate the banana submissively and closed his eyes after telling Milo it was good. But Milo shook him awake again and instructed him to get dressed as quickly as he could because they were leaving at once for Pianosa.
"You and Orr have to load the bananas into the plane right away," he explained. "The man said to watch out for spiders while you're handling the bunches."
"Milo, can't we wait until morning?" Yossarian pleaded. "I've got to get some sleep."
"They're ripening very quickly," answered Milo, "and we don't have a minute to lose. Just think how happy the men back at the squadron will be once they get these bananas."
But the men back at the squadron never even saw any of the bananas, for it was a seller's market for bananas in Istanbul and a buyer's market in Beirut for the caraway seeds Milo rushed with to Benghazi after selling the bananas. And when they raced back into Pianosa breathlessly 6 days later at the conclusion of Orr's rest leave, it was with a load of best white eggs from Sicily that Milo said were from Egypt and sold to his mess halls for only 4 cents apiece so that all the commanding officers in his syndicate would implore him to speed right back to Cairo for more bunches of green-red bananas to sell in Turkey for the caraway seeds in demand in Benghazi. And everybody had a share.